Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I am the Director of Digital Services at Eastwick Communications. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today on this lovely San Francisco Bay Area day where I have the pleasure of speaking with CEO, entrepreneur, and adventurous Peter Shankman, father of Haro, otherwise known as Help a Reporter Out, and author of Can We Do That? Outrageous PR Stunts That Work and Why Your Company Needs Them. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much. You forgot Infamous, as mentioned on your blog.
Yeah, of course. You actually really need no introduction, I think.
Wow, I'm flattered.
Did you like that I got the screenshot from you being on television?
Yeah, from like a piece I did on MSNBC about 4 years ago. Yeah, way to keep up with the times.
I know. Hey, your mug hasn't changed that much, right? You're still skydiving, you know, it keeps you young. I looked through your pictures. I tried to pick one. So where are you in the world today, Peter?
Right now I'm on the M57 crosstown bus, somewhere between 6th Avenue and the West Side Highway.
New York City.
I'm in New York City, a bus. But the bus is very, very underrated in New York. Not enough people take the bus.
Well, I went to Columbia for grad school, and I took buses a lot because I went to the journalism school, and they send you all over to do reporting, as you may know. Pardon?
No, if you're far west or far east or whatever, the buses rock. No one knows about them. They're great. You see people, and if you look at people, and they're like, "Oh, we know the bus secret."
The bus secrets. Well, I'm glad to be in on something, I guess, in New York today. Let's jump right into it. How do you describe yourself these days, Peter? Because I think it's interesting from my point of view as sort of an underling wannabe influencer possibly even, where you are teaching people about the influence of social media and the tactics that you can use and the power of it to you becoming one of the power players.
I think the funny thing is that when people – you know, I've heard people describe themselves as influencers. There's actually a guy on Twitter whose username is Key Influencer, which if you have to describe yourself as an influencer, automatically means you're not an influencer. And it's like the same people who go up to you at a bar and go, you know, "Hey, I'm great in bed. You should come home with me." You're going to throw a drink in their face. But if you're with your best friend and your best friend sees them and goes, "Oh, my God, you should go home with them. They're great in bed," you're getting laid. You know, and I think too many people, in the social media space are literally – you know, Amy Africa had one of the best quotes I ever heard. She said, "If I had a dollar for everyone, who called themselves a social media influencer, a social media, guru," she said she'd be on the top of the Fortune 500 list, tomorrow. I don't call myself anything other than someone who is very, very fortunate to love what I do. I connect people using any tool at my disposal, and I have a lot of fun doing it. And in the end. In the end, if I can help a lot of people out and generate some good karma, it's been a good day.
Yeah. And I think you clearly generate, some great karma with your service, Help a Reporter Out. And I call it a service for a very good reason because it's something that gets, clients at our firm and even me quoted various places. And I think a lot of people can claim that. Where did the idea come from for Haro, Help a Reporter Out?
Well, I've run a PR firm for 10 years, and in doing that, every year I'd send out an email. I call it a good karma email to reporters. Every mid-January, it was cold and I was in my apartment, and I started out sending it to a couple hundred journalists, basically just saying, "Hey, what's going on? What are you working on? What are you doing? Do you need any help? I know a lot of sources. If you need anyone, let me know. I'll gladly recommend someone to you." And that, it was just to be nice, And over like 5 or 6 years, that email grew and grew and grew to the point where I was sending it out to 3,000 or 4,000 journalists, and it was taking a ridiculous amount of time to do it. And reporters were calling me back and saying, "Oh wow, yeah, hey, I got your name from so and so, and I'm doing a story on this or on that." And I had no idea at this point; it was so out of my control. I'm like, "Oh crap!" The builder was the guy who called and said, "I'm doing a story on Nigerian farming," and I was told that you know lots of soil experts in sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm sitting there on the looking at the phone going, "That's how I organize all my friends," and it was a little crazy. So So I said, okay, if I can push these queries out, you know, push these queries out to my media friends, to my, you know, my source friends, let them figure out if they know anyone. You know, that would be easier. And so that's what I tried doing. And I started that, and the next thing I knew, I built a Facebook group with about 100 of my friends in it. The next thing I knew, we had 1,200 members in it or something like that. And it grew too big for Facebook. And so I moved on to the web. Very basic premise called Help a Reporter. I never planned on making money from it. I figured it would just be something to do, make some new friends, and, you know, maybe grow my brand a little bit. And then people started joining up left and right. People started recommending it. Then I started getting calls from advertisers and saying, hey, you know, you have a really sort of interesting list there. We'd love to give you some money and put some of our stuff on it. And next thing I know, we're at, you know, today we're at a little over close to 80,000 members. And,
wow.
We are sold out on advertising until the pretty much the end of August at this point. Three emails a day, and it's pretty crazy. And it's become my full-time job. I don't have clients anymore. I do this, and I occasionally travel and give speaking gigs.
That's great. So tell me about the demo of the people that are signed up. Do you know much about the individuals that have signed up to the service? Because it's free to sign up, we should tell people.
Yeah, it's free for everybody to sign up. It's free to use it. There's never a charge to you ever on either side for a journalist or a source. Well, I can tell you the demographics on the journalist side range from CNN to the New York Times to the Today Show to Good Morning America to the Wall Street Journal to People Magazine. I mean, you name it. If it's a media outlet, it's using Harrow. On the source side, the sources range from CEOs of Fortune 100s all the way to small mom-and-pop bakeries who have never been able to do PR before, have never afforded it, and are now landing pieces in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and they're writing me these emails, you know, like, oh, my God, we were about to close, the economy really killed us, and then we got in the New York Times from your story, and oh, my God, you know, it's the greatest thing in the world. So the demographics are so, they just switch depending on, you know, who's there. And the interesting thing is we probably have about close to 5,000 journalists who are on the list as well. So when you're an advertiser, not only are you being seen by like 100,000, you know, or close to 100,000 members, you're also being seen by like 5,000 journalists who met more than once have said, hey, that's a really interesting advertiser. I didn't know about them. Let's write a piece about them.
Yeah. It's amazing how self-propelling things that work in the online world, things that work just self-propel. They should. If it's hard, if it's a lot of uphill struggle for something click with people, it won't work. I'm convinced of that. It either takes or it doesn't. You know that pretty quickly.
You know what I find funny? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please. I want to hear the funny
thing. I was going to say, I created this thing, and basically what I created was the ability to let other people use it. I mean, my goal was, hey, if you don't fit this source, but you know someone who does, send it to them. You know, feel free to forward it. I'm more than happy for you to forward this email to whoever wants to see it. And so what happened is, you know, you might not know about, you might be an accountant that might not know about farming, but you know what, you might have a friend next door who knows about farming, and you forward it to him, he gets quoted. He's like, holy crap, thank you so much. Where'd you get this? And you're a hero. And he says, oh, where'd you get this? Like, oh, I subscribed to this list, Help a Reporter. Wow, I should sign up for that. You know, there's no downside in signing up to it, other than the fact that you have to hear starting June 1st about my marathon training. I'm hearing me bitch about that. But other than that, you know, there's no downside to it. So.
It's sort of
email crack.
We should let listeners know that didn't read Haro today that Peter's gone into marathon training for the New York Marathon and no alcohol. So we
As of June 1st. I have one more week just basically get drunk off my ass. Come June 1st, I'm dry until November.
Right. So we'll do the collective for you right now.
Yeah.
And wish you well on that one, because I think that would be very, very hard for me anyway, and probably a few other people. You know, I was going to ask about, you know, we clearly know Haro is influential, but you know, like anything else, when you use something a lot, you think of it, you know, as relative to where you are in the world. But have you seen really a global reach with Haro?
Oh, yeah, no question about it. I mean, we have reporters asking questions from Der Spiegel, which is Germany's number one outlet. We get a lot of London, a lot of Canada. We're just starting to get Italy. We're just starting to get Australia, which is pretty cool. We're starting to get the Sydney Morning Herald and things like that. And then we're starting to get queries from like South America. And the nice thing about it is that we're getting – what happens is the way this works is that some reporter will see it, write a little piece about it on a blog or somewhere. That'll get, you know, a couple thousand new subscribers to join it from, you know, from different countries. And then these subscribers will go and tell their favorite journalists, hey, have you heard about this thing? And these journalists have used it, everyone wins. So it's an awesome, awesome sort of reciprocal self-fulfilling prophecy there.
Yeah. Now, I'm kind of an analytics geek. I love learning about, you know, things, especially psychology and stuff like that. So I'm going to ask you this, and if you don't know the answer, that's cool. But we've been looking at, you know, influence for a while. That's kind of one of the obsessions of our firm, that and storytelling. So, you know, in terms of the discussions we have on the influence of press, lately we've been asking ourselves, you know, what's the difference between U.S. press influence and U.K. press influence or other places in the world globally? So where is the most influence happening? Where are the decisions being made that affect, for lack of a better evaluation method, purchasing decisions?
Well, I've seen, you know, obviously you get a .com address, people just naturally assume U.S. But, you know, mm-hmm. on the same note, you know, you look at something like a wonderful little email list that goes out once a week called Pop Bitch. Pop Bitch mm-hmm. is basically, it's the equivalent of like if Gawker were an email newsletter, but like 1,000 times snarkier and only once a week and only focused on British press, it would be Pop Bitch. And this thing is huge, huge, huge in Europe. And you know, it's this massive, massive collection of just stories and gossip and innuendo, but they have such a ridiculously large following that mainstream media quotes from it. And so what I'm starting to see happen is the more, you know, basically it doesn't matter where you're based. You're based on a rock. You're under a rock at Sao Paulo. If you're bringing in quality people, and by quality people I mean numbers, you know, and they're seeing you, they're irrelevant as to where you are. So
yeah,
I'm seeing from purchase in terms of that. You know, I'll run an ad. I ran an ad from some guy who has he's based out of an apartment, and no one cares. You know, he's selling something. It's complete dropship, the whole thing. He's selling millions of dollars worth. It's the same. I mean, Harrow is a perfect example of that. No one cares. Logistically, no one cares. Get the product, get the following. No one cares for the base or where you are geographically. It's simply a question of can the product be fulfilled at such and such a time through such and such a means. If the answer is yes, the Internet has turned us into not caring, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just was wondering if there was sort of a correlation between, and it sounds like you're getting pickup everywhere, but when we look at, you know, sort of circulation of, you know, publications that actually still print publications, you see, like, The Economist numbers are up, Financial Times are doing really well.
You're never gonna lose intelligent reporting, you know. And I was talking about this. I was giving a speech a couple of last week, and Warren Buffett said something really interesting. He said, "Imagine if the internet already existed." He said, "Imagine if the internet already existed, but newspapers did not." And I came to a board meeting one day and said, "Okay, here's what I want to do. I want to spend a lot of money to chop down a whole bunch of trees, and then I want to spend a lot of money to create inks." And I want to put the inks on this mashed up pulp that I'm going to make from the trees. Then I want to hire people, 17-year-old kids, to go out and distribute this mashed up pulp with ink on it. You know, and everyone would look at them and say, well, why? Everything's distributed online. And he said, no, I just have an idea. You'd look at him like he was insane. Right? Because basically, he's basically saying is that I want to create newspapers. But if you already have the Internet, if you already have the Internet, what do you need them for? So, yes, everyone's bemoaning the death of the Internet. Or I'm sorry, the death of the newspaper. But what we're doing is, I think we're bemoaning the wrong thing. We're bemoaning the death of the newspaper, but we're not talking about the death of a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important. The good journalists are not going to go away regardless of what the medium is. We didn't lose all the journalists when we switched from regular Kodak 100-speed film to digital photography. We didn't lose the journalists. We didn't lose the photojournalists. They didn't go away. Okay, and so
we see these journalists
getting laid off, and they are finding new ways to distribute their information and get their information out. So I think we need to be really clear. Are we bemoaning the death of newspaper, or are we bemoaning the death of the journalism industry? The latter is a lot less to worry about than the former.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Nick Denton said yesterday in Ad Age that original reporting will always be rewarded, which is kind of along the lines of what you're saying, which is that, you know, basically quality journalism will never go away. But, you
exactly.
know, as a journalism school graduate and looking at my listservs, I have people that, you know, are so qualified that come from The Deal and other, you know, publications of you know, that are of interest, at least to our client base, that are applying for an internship. The reality is, you know, how are they going to continue to make money? And I think that we're seeing this huge transition right now. Any thoughts on that?
I think that the eyeball, there's no question there's a lesser attention span for people to actually read something, you know, and I think that what we're looking at right now is we're in the middle ground, okay, where we have the point where we're losing newspapers, and as such we're losing eyeballs, and we're losing ability to grab eyeballs, and nothing other than the Internet and the Internet as a whole, okay, nothing's come in to replace that. Where's that new thing going to come from? Okay, the Internet was the new thing for newspaper. The Internet is still there. Newspapers are starting to go away. What's the new thing that's going to make it, instead of newspapers and Internet, it's going to become Internet and what?
Mm-hmm.
What is that? And I think that we haven't seen yet. I don't know what it is. Whatever it is, it'll probably be owned by Google. I don't know what it is yet, though. You know? And so,
our neighbors in Mountain View.
Exactly. So the question, you know, then they're freaking goats. So the question becomes, you know, what is that? Is that on-demand video, is it something like what Hulu's doing, but is it pre-programmable? Are we going to be paying people to choose what we want to see? I mean, I'm always of the opinion that the biggest difference that we're seeing right now in terms of this whole social media thing and all that is that information used to flow into the network, at which point we would disseminate it, i.e., we would read a review in the New York Times about the restaurant. We would tell our friends, hey, there was a review in the New York Times about this restaurant. We should go there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we go to the restaurant, we review it, and everyone in our network gets that information.
Mm-hmm.
So the information which used to go into the network from outside is going from the network to, or in, outside into the network is now going from the network to the outside.
Hence the retirement or the movement of the New York Times leading food critic, I guess.
Exactly. And look, they're the ones leading the bleed out. They are leading the bleed out, you know?
People finding other things to do.
People who are telling us what to think are leading the bleed out. And, you know, I mean, look at the fact that they took, what, 80% of New Jersey's coverage, and they're doing it through citizen journalism now? The only reason that didn't make more of a bigger splash in the world than it did is because, well, quite frankly, it's New Jersey. But other than that, you know, there was a lot of information about that.
Well, so that, you know, that I think brings up all kinds of interesting questions. All these are realities, obviously, that we know. One is, do you ever think about, you know, so the word journalist is kind of, you know, I think fairly vague for most people right now. I think in the PR world, especially when there used to be a real clear demarcation between this person's a journalist, this person is a blogger, it really doesn't matter anymore. Anyone that can write that has an audience, is influential, possibly has a brand, is really someone that you want to make sure you get your client in front of.
But they need to know how to write. That is the most important thing in the free world. They need to know how to write now more than ever.
Yes, that I would agree with.
We are dismissing the majority of the bloggers and the majority of the journalists out there because they can't write for crap. And as journalists, we're dismissing 99.9% of the pitches we get because we just don't have the time anymore. We used to actually look at crappy pitches. We just mm-hmm. actually say, all right, you know what, he can't, wow, there's a spelling error, but you know what, well, we'll see, maybe I'll keep reading, maybe it gets interesting. Screw that. We have 2.7 seconds nowadays to actually listen to what someone's saying. You think that we're going to waste that time? Hell no.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've said this before on other podcasts. I worked in the television media and specifically in new media for more than a decade, and I only read one press release, and it was from someone that I knew from working in journalism who had moved to the PR side. That's the only thing I ever read, and I did do a story on it. I did an online-only story on it, and that was like in the early 2000s. But I never looked at press releases. I never needed to. I mean, frankly, the information was just sort of there, especially as an early adopter.
Yep.
You know, I remember one of the first big jobs I had was when I came to the ABC affiliate in San Francisco, and they were still City Search. And City Search had decided, well, we're going to change our business model, and we're not going to be attached to these local stations anymore. So my job was to bring it out of the City Search era and into something that was defined with Disney Internet Group. So,
yep.
You know, was one of the people that signed one of the first deals with Mark Cuban when he still owned Broadcast.com. And, you know, now I watch them on the sidelines of basketball games. So, you know, it's just interesting how things change over time. I think, though, that, you know, one of the things, when I go back to your book, you know, Can We Do That? Outrageous PR Stunts That Work and Why Your Company Needs Them. That came out in, what, 2006?
Early 2006.
So between 2006 and now, what would you write differently in that book? I mean, how do you view sort of this idea of, you know, the idea that you promote there, which is you need to do wacky, crazy things to get attention?
The biggest difference right now is that the wacky, crazy, I'll give you a perfect example. Back in 1998, I started my first PR firm. I came up with the idea. The movie Titanic was coming out in video. It was that small independent film, a small independent film about a boat. Everywhere you looked, you saw signs, you know, buy Titanic on video, buy it on video, blah, blah. And I figured there had to be someone else as sick of this as me. So I had 500 T-shirts printed up. I went into Times Square, and I figured I could sell 180 and make enough money to maybe start my PR firm and pay off a credit card. So I did it. I went to Times Square. I figured it would take about a week to sell 180. I sold 500 shirts in 6 hours. I came home. I threw 5 grand up in the air, rolled around it naked. Long story short, I told a reporter at USA Today what I did. She thought it was hysterical. She asked me if I was selling them online. I lied. I went, of course I am, and built the worst website known to man. And she ran the story on the front page of the Life section of USA Today. The next day, I sold about 10,000 shirts on the web in 2 months. Now, there was no fulfillment. There was no cafe press. There was no blog. People would click. I'd send them my address. They'd send me a check. I'd mail them a shirt. Okay? So, I mean, there was nothing. But, and because of that, my barrier for entry was I had cash or credit cards to buy 500 shirts and do the initial sale. And then I had the room in my studio apartment to bring in 1,000 shirts at a time and sell them online. Now, mind you, you know, I was sleeping on them because I had no room in my studio apartment. But the point being is that you do that now. Okay, you come up with an idea like that, as basic as a T-shirt that reads, "It sank, get over it." Okay, the anti-Titanic T-shirt. You go to Times Square and you sell that shirt now online, or you sell that shirt now in Times Square. The first person who buys it takes a picture of you selling it to him, posts it on YouTube. In 5 seconds, there are 30 people with a cafe press, you know, anti-Titanic shirt website, all with better graphics, all with better ideas, all getting it online. The first person with the biggest network wins. So what does that teach us? That teaches us that our ideas have to be better. So between the time I wrote the book and now, the ideas, the stunts you do, they have to have a purpose. A PR stunt for the sake of a PR stunt is pointless. A PR stunt that has a purpose that ties into a bigger cause and that coattails on something else brilliant is much, much better. Now so more than ever when you have 348 million people walking around with digital cameras in their cell phones.
And shaping the way news is run these days.
Yep.
So, I think that's an interesting example, but it obviously brings me back to kind of the things that we think about in strategic planning for some of our clients who are B2B. And I think that there's a different challenge there. It's not necessarily higher or worse or better or whatever, but it's different. What, did you ever work with B2B clients? Do you have any B2B stories?
I've had B2B clients, countless numbers of them, yes. And so, I think that what B2B clients have to think about is not so much doing the crazy stunt or anything like that, but creating a better brand online that makes them more trusted.
Okay.
Social media, social media, like I said, is nothing more than a tool. But if we're moving towards this one network, one world situation where everyone everyone's in our network, and then before we go to any company or buy something from anyone, we go into our network, see who knows them, who's worked with them, where the reviews are coming from. Companies are going to have to work on making their brands more trusted, making their brands more aware, making people more centric. In other words, if you have a problem with company X does you wrong, company X better be on the phone fixing the problem the second they notice it. So company X needs to be more aware of people getting angry, of people getting mad, and go online and fix them. Comcast Cares is a great example. Verizon has a Twitter account now. So all that stuff because in the end, you know, what's going to wind up happening is I'm going to go online, I'm posting my Facebook status update, you know, call me Verizon later to have 3 lines installed, and I'm going to get 50 people going, no, you don't want to do that. They suck. Call my guy over at Comcast because he was much more reactive or much more proactive or whatever. You're going to get much more immediate feedback on what you should and should not do. And because it's coming from people within your network that have a relevance to you, it's coming from people you trust. And because that trust is there, you're much more likely to believe someone who you in your network over the random guy from the Verizon store who says, no, don't worry, our service is great.
So what do you think
businesses need to be much more aware of that because it's going to be the same thing on a business-to-business platform. As we go to one network, it's not just going to be about using social media for fun. You know, we used to use Google to Google things. Now it's just part of the lexicon. Social media as a concept is going to become part of the lexicon. And when it does, you know, it's, you're not going to make a decision without going on your network, business to business or business to personal, and seeing who knows about what you're doing or is involved in it. And then that's where those people, oh, wow, look at that Tom, who I worked with last year and played golf with, that had a real problem when he ordered those Spacely sprockets. Maybe I won't use Spacely. Maybe I'll use Jepson's sprockets.
So in
business to personal, they need to be much more aware. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. I think that absolutely makes sense. You know, I mean, that's one of the things, though, I wonder about is that, you know, there's always a move to automate. So though Twitter is just a tool, and we know that tools change and companies, you know, one of the things that I talk with them about all the time is the ability to be nimble, you know, that we're teaching them strategies, but really the tool should be insignificant, though you'll hear buzz about Twitter, so we need to have you there. If your customers are there. So we do the research first to make sure that they're there. They usually are. And, you know, usually you have two goals. You have one, customer service, and two is some sort of business development if there happen to be leads, right? So those are the two things that you're looking at. Those are universal, right? Those are things that you would look on at pretty much any tool. But what makes me go, and wonder a bit is when Salesforce.com has now put out an app that, you know, plugs into Twitter and tickets through their CRM process, you know, Twitter complaints and, you know, concerns. You know, are people going to continue to see the same kind of Comcast Cares attention if it's all through a CRM-based system?
End result, if it's if they won't, they'll complain about it, and that system in the long run will not work. You know, look, it's not rocket science. If I know when I'm pissed off and I make a phone call, I know if it's an automated response or if it's a person.
Right.
And
you're
I don't care. I'm sorry?
You're Gen X, right?
Yeah. But you know what?
Yeah.
My dad's not, and he knows the difference.
No, but let's go younger. So let's talk about millennials.
Younger's going to be even worse. Younger's going to be even worse. You start creating an automated form. Oh my God! I'll give you a perfect example, and it's amazing how we repeat ourselves in history. I just screwed up a perfectly good quote. If we don't learn from history, we're doomed to repeat it. Thank you. Okay. 20 years ago. Remember Whip? Do you remember Whipple and Channel One?
Oh yeah.
Okay, where he basically came in, and he said, "Okay, we got these kids. We got 50 million of them. They have them. They're watching TV for an hour, and because they're watching TV in school, they're psyched. They're going to do it. And by the way, we have them. They have to listen to our commercials. And because it's TV in school, it's going to be cool, and they're totally going to listen to our advertisers. Awesome. Remember what happened? Kids went out of their way to avoid the advertisers shown on Channel One because the second you market to a kid and say, 'I got you,' you don't have them. Okay?
Yeah,
that was 20 years ago. The kids
and you had a lot of schools not air the stuff, even though it was free and potentially informational because there were ads in it.
Yes, but and the ones who did add it, and the kids immediately rejected it. Now you look at companies who are saying, we'll put an automated response. But do you think kids today who are online already for 3 seconds before they go somewhere else because they get bored are not going to understand the difference between a normal response and an automated response? They're going to want exactly that same level of customer service, and they're going to know, "Hi, Peter. Thank you. We're so sorry. You're having a problem with your computer." Yeah, come on. They'll know it in a heartbeat, whether it's online, digital, Twitter. You know, all they have to do, and I love this, they tried the same thing 6 years ago with aimbots. Automated bots for aims? We see how well that went.
Oh, yeah.
The second you said one thing it didn't understand, a shot back a generic response, then it became a game to make the most inane question create the most generic response. So I said, what does color blue taste like? Well, Peter, it is in fact a gorgeous day with blue skies. You know, it's like, I love when that happened.
The bot that IKEA had was probably the most abused by me because of just trying to ask basic questions about, you know, bedding, you know, is it a California king or is it a, you know, a regular king or, you know, things like that. Bot couldn't answer it. Whatever I tried, it wouldn't work. So I started cursing at it and getting really interesting pat responses. So then I tried doing things like you were talking about where you start talking about colors or the things like that. And then you get sort of the recommendations engine early start part thing where, you know, it's saying, oh, well, we have, you know, these products available. Yeah, so people absolutely can tell. But what I wonder about the millennial generation, and a good friend of mine, Morley Winograd, is a co-author of the Millennial Makeover book that came out last year. where, you know, it talks about millennials being a lot less likely to judge authority, which I really wonder in this internet age. And, I specifically look at kind of the sort of strides that were made during the election in terms of social media and how people reacted and got involved as something really particularly interesting. But then how it's playing out now in terms of, you know, MoveOn.org and others trying to get people to continue to engage, and I see a drop-off. And I'm just, you know, is it, you know, how much of this, so, you know, and again, you know, a lot of people found out, quote-unquote, about Twitter through either Oprah joining or that whole thing with Ashton Kutcher. You know, how much of this is really celebrity and personality-driven in terms of tool sets right now?
I think that we're seeing the start of a backlash. I don't think we've – I think hopefully the backlash – okay, use your words, Peter. We've never had something so quick to react like Twitter before, okay? As such, anything that happened backlashable in the, I don't know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, I don't even know what it is. When Hands Across America didn't work, you know, whatever you want to use as a choice. I have to also preface right now that I'm walking up the street with my assistant who just met me, and the wind is really strong on 11th Avenue, and she's walking with both hands trying to keep her dress from blowing. It is probably one of the funniest things I've seen in the past 5 years. So,
is that
so
Megan?
It's Megan. Yeah, you're witnessing this live on Blog Talk Radio as it happens. Both her hands covering, trying to hold down this dress.
Poor Megan.
Dumbass, what were you thinking? Oh, yeah, awesome. So, anyway, what I think we're seeing now is it's such a big growth in immediate reaction that I'm hopeful that when people do these stupid things, like Autobots or like having other people tweet for them or using auto-tweet, anything like that, what I'm hopeful is that we're going to see more people learning immediately from their mistakes and those mistakes going away. What used to take a year for people to realize they were being idiots about, hopefully will start to be quicker, and we won't see such a dramatic, oh my God, you're freaking stupid, type reaction anymore.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, still, how does the celebrity culture affect which channels we're using? I mean, Twitter is a perfect example right now because everybody's there, but when I actually do audits of online presence for my clients, I am seeing people use Plurk and Identica and, you know, a bunch of other microblogs. And when I present that to some of our account teams, sometimes I get, huh? What is that? What's Plurk? I have no idea what that is. And we go back to Twitter is a microblog. There are other microblogs of which it is, you know, one. And, you know, kind of trying to explain the fact that, again, it's a distribution channel. But I feel like the celebrification of the channel has added, and I, you know, so I guess I'm backlashing as we speak. I feel like it's created this frustrating influence on tool over strategy, or tool over even the basic tactics you should employ over any tool that acts as though Twitter does, right?
Well, look, 99% of the people will jump on a bandwagon simply because it's there. The smart ones are realizing they're nothing more than just tools. You know, a marketing campaign doesn't go away simply because you have a brand new tool. Rather, you learn to implement the marketing campaign and use the tool to benefit it. And if the tool doesn't benefit it, you don't use the tool. I tell a great story about my father, who's a brilliant jazz musician, but he's not a carpenter yet. That never stops buying the latest toy at Sears, coming home, destroying a birdhouse every freaking year. Just because you have the tools doesn't mean you should use them.
That's a very good example. Any examples of things in the Twitter sphere, blogosphere, online, that are bugging you right now?
Companies that use Twitter to announce when they're open and when they're closed. We'll be open from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. That doesn't help me. People who still to this day are still using blogs to post their entire press release. They should be shot.
So how should they distribute?
They don't need to distribute the press release. They should not be distributing the press release on their blog. If I want a blog, I want little bits of information. I don't want every – and I should rephrase that. I don't want every blog post to be each press release. If I'm reading a blog, it's because I don't want to go to the corporate site and read the information coming from corporate, which I know is typed up by a little PR drone, What I want, if I'm reading a blog, I want the CEO to tell me what's up. I want to tell me the great idea he had this morning when he was running. You know, I want that kind of information sent to me in a better way. Because for whatever reason, that's what that, you know, better for worse, I think that's what blogs are supposed to be used for. And to use a blog to post nothing more than the corporate PR department's information is a perfectly good waste of space you have on your corporate site. Let's not confuse a corporate site with a corporate blog.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we tell people to put press releases online, we're not telling them to put them to put that in the stream of their blogging.
No,
that's
put them online, and don't send me a tweet that says my latest blog post is about the press release.
Yeah, it could still be on a blogging platform, but it should be separate and made into.
No, exactly. But I'm not talking about, and my apologies because you did start off with tools, so I should have been more clear. What I'm saying is that the concept of a blog, you can use WordPress to create a corporate site. I have no problem with that. But don't send me information on a blog. If I'm reading a blog and I'm looking for that personal touch, as written by our CEO, I can tell you, hands down, 1,001, the CEO did not write that press release.
I think everyone agrees with you on that, absolutely. And I, you know, I have my own view of press releases from being in the industry for a long time. I have a question for you. So this is sort of a theory that I have that 3 to 5 years from now, maybe less, that press release distribution as we have it today, MarketWire, et cetera, could go away, or it's going to have to change significantly.
That's really funny. If you Google Peter Shankman and press release prediction, I've been saying for the past year that 24 to 36 months, press release will be dead. As we know it, will be dead. You won't be putting it on the wire. You'll be SEOing it and making really smart moves into it, and that information will be going live, not as a press release, but as information distributed the way the reporter wants it. Whether it's 5,000 reporters, you will distribute it all the ways each of those reporters want it.
So what insight do you have into how they want it? Because this goes into, you know, the recommendations we make about, you know, putting rich media when possible, when it makes sense, you know. I mean, people want to see a demo of a product if they're trying to write about it. I know that, right?
Fine, link to it.
The world. But what other things do you see, you know, when, you know, you're interacting with a world that, you know, that the folks I'm around are trying to touch? So what are the rich media trends or other trends that you see that reporters are asking for? This is what we want to be available on a corporate site. Are you still with us? I think I may have lost Peter Shankman. He's gone. Well, getting back to the prediction about press releases, and I'll talk about this for a minute. Hopefully we'll have him call back in a second. Is that, oh, looks like he's back. Let me unmute him.
That wasn't me. I swear to God, that wasn't me.
So you're back on air now, Peter.
I swear to God, that wasn't me. I'm like, I'm talking. I looked at Megan. I'm like, oh, crap, she's gone. And Megan's like, that was live? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, she looked at me. She goes, I didn't do it. I'm like, I know. I'm on the phone with her.
All right, let me, at this point, that's okay. I'll take this opportunity to do our reopen right now. For those just joining us, welcome to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay of Eastwood Communications. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick, and this week we're speaking with the infamous, there's the word, Peter Shankman of Haro, among other things.
My mom read your blog. My mom read that. She saw, she goes, you're not infamous, you're nice. I'm like, I know. Obviously this woman doesn't like me.
No, infamous is great.
You got my mom on your ass now. I hope you're happy.
Well, you know, I'll take any
mom.
She's
been a teacher in the South Bronx for 29 years. You don't want that.
The South Bronx has got nice areas.
Now it does. She taught in the South Bronx in the 70s.
Well, I do feel sorry for her. Is it Mrs. Shankman? Is it Mrs. Shankman? Should I do an apology
Shankman,
to Mrs.
Yes.
Shankman? Mrs. Shankman,
Mrs. Shankman,
I'm so sorry. We love Peter.
She's at choir director on Twitter. Make sure you apologize.
Okay, I definitely will, especially because I'm accused often of being the ADHD gal in my world. So I'm
trying
to get really
calm. Oh, we should get
married
and produce Seriously Off the Wall Kids.
Well, unfortunately, I've already taken the dive and married someone else. So I'm going to have little English kids that are really calm, and that'll freak me out.
Oh, there you go. That's a little weird.
So, you know, Yeah, you will. Don't worry. When you're on Fox News, you're going to have all those blonde women, the shiksas, right? Anyway, we're getting off topic here. So I really wanted to ask you, you know, I want to continue what I was sort of asking you about before, which was this whole sense of the needs of reporters and bloggers, anybody writing online, and what corporations need to make and be aware of, companies too. I shouldn't just say corporations because, you know, we represent startups too. We're trying to do the good, fight the good fight and put out good products in this crappy economy. You know, what kinds of, you know, what is the feedback you're hearing? What should we be telling them to make available? You know, obviously demos make sense where possible, but in terms of rich media, you know, I get concerned about us making, you know, telling them to produce rich media for rich media's sake. We want to make sure that there's some strategy behind it. What do you think, you know, what's the demand? What are people asking for?
You know what I'm hearing a lot of, obviously no one wants links, no one wants attachments, no one wants any of that. They still want links. They want links to a really, really clean site. What they want, what I'm hearing is twofold. They want links to a two-part site, one that says click here if you're on BlackBerry. Because more and more emails are being made on BlackBerries and iPhones, and while iPhones do have some power, they don't have full power. You're not gonna see a 3D modeling demo on an iPhone. So what they're saying is, click here if you're on an iPhone or mobile. Click here for real. And so you create two little sites. One, the mobile site, have more than text, the easiest thing in the world, a couple of images, and then your real site, and you let reporters have the choice. Because if you say click here for this information, and they're on their mobile and they can't get it immediately, the chances are of them coming back pretty minimal.
Yeah.
You know, once your email's above the fold, pretty much say goodbye. So You want to hit a reporter, give them the option, and let them at least look at it. Let them get their curiosity piqued on their berry, so that when they get home, they could say, "Hey, let me," or get the office and say, "Hey, let me take a look at that."
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
Give them the option of something else.
Mobile optimized is so important, especially when it's so easy on so many of the platforms we're talking about, like WordPress.
Yeah.
You can mobile optimize really simply.
It is. It's even worse to be able to say, you know, hey, I had a perfectly good shot with this reporter, but I didn't get them because I couldn't give them the information the way they wanted it, and now they're not going to come back to look at it again.
Yeah. When I was working at an online video company a while back, you know, one of the things that I've been saying is people don't, you know, people get so fixated on, you know, is IPTV going to come to the U.S. in the same way that we've seen it, you know, grow across the U.K. really quickly. Well, things don't happen as quickly here because we can't just do, you know, we do things by committee. So it takes a really long time sometimes for standards to get in place. And so then conversion takes a lot longer. And I can't believe we still haven't done HD conversion, although it's coming quickly. But, you know, it's interesting how, you know, here people don't want to disclose as much about themselves yet. In Europe, they're very conditioned to because of the socialized country mentality of, we'll give you lots of interesting information about ourselves. And so you get these great case studies. But they're talking about things in terms of, you know, pounds or, you know, euros or whatever, and it sort of doesn't translate. What are some of the best case studies, if any, that you've seen lately about the effect of online in any of the ways that we talk about it? So, you know, analytics, anything from analytics to email.
I know that oh, now I'm totally going to screw this up. I was on a panel. But you know what? I'll send you the info you post online. I was on a panel about a month ago, PRSA in Silicon Valley.
Uh-huh.
Silicon Valley, and they were talking. Who the hell was on the panel with me? It was
I remember seeing that your name was on the event.
It was with Sam Whitmore was the moderator. And if we Google it right now, which I don't have a computer for me, I can tell you it was. It was a big company. A big company. I can't remember for the life of me who they were, and they were talking all about how they monitor it. They take every single number. They do Dell. Okay, I feel better now. It was Dell. They do any campaign they do, they immediately look at it, and they immediately can tell number-wise, analytics-wise. They say they're more analytics than anything else they get out of that information. And they say it's, you know, it's saving them millions of dollars and making them millions of dollars and all that.
Huh, that's interesting. So this was Is this ad?
They're saying that everything is about analytics, and they say if they're going to use Twitter and if they're going to go explore a Facebook ad or whatever, they better damn well have the numbers to back it up. You know?
Yeah, I mean,
they're I think it's so smart.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're one of the ones. there's a company, actually, we interviewed Sam Whitmore last week, and he warned me about you. I guess I got to tell your mom. I got to give her another, you know.
What did he say? Did he say I was too hyper? I'll be him.
No, you're definitely not too hyper. I can handle any level of hyper. No, but, you know, Sam, he's very kickback. He's different.
Totally. I love him.
Totally different speed, but he's so great, and he works with us a lot. But in any event, you know, going back to this whole concept of, you know, the idea should be that whatever the information is, it shouldn't. We have to figure out what all the channels are that our users are using, rather than vice versa. One of the interesting things is a few weeks ago we had a good friend of mine, Kevin Spear, who's over at Bunchball, and I don't know if you've seen their Nitro product, but it's an overlay basically to they created the Dunder Mifflin Infinity site, but it's this
right.
The incentive site. And Dell's using it on their user forum, and they found out by using this, and I thought this was so smart, and I, you know, would love to let Kevin loose on every client we have with a user forum. But basically, they found a guy that had answered 20,000 support questions on the Dell forum, on the Dell main support forum, correctly.
Wow.
You know, prime example of you need the metrics to be able to incentivize him, to thank him, to do something, to acknowledge his contribution.
No question about
it. They can then quantify how much money they've saved because of the man and everything else that goes along with it. So, I mean, it's a really fantastic example of being really smart about partnering with companies or using connections to, you know, overlay onto a technology platform you already have a piece of software that can run and create incentives and badges and, you know, that run off that those instincts, the human emotions that we all still feel, which I think, you know, sometimes gets lost in all of this, that, you know, we're all human. We all have feelings about, you know, these different things, which is why I get so interested in sort of the backlash scenario. Which is why I'll follow up with, what do you think is the next thing? So I think that it's fair to say there's some Twitter backlash right now from the early adopters who are saying,
backlash,
you know,
to everything. But you know what? I think if, before we even talk about Twitter backlash, we need to understand the difference between Twitter and Twittering. Twittering,
okay, go for it.
Twittering is not going away. The concept of issuing short statements to either help provide information, do better customer service, that is now here to stay. Whether it is on Twitter or not, whether it is done on Twitter or not, is irrelevant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was like...
And that's a really big point, because we might be backlashing Twitter. Fine, whatever the next thing is, we'll backlash that. We're a society that loves to backlash. We're not,
absolutely.
You know, we have a miserable flight. We're not truly happy about our miserable flight until we've called 15 people on our cell phones and made them miserable as well. It's just the kind of society we love to live in. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point because, you know, obviously, like, you know, as I had said before, when I do analytic audits and I look at all of the different microblogs that people are using, you know, sometimes, you know, classic case was one competitor we have, or one, you know, one of our companies, main source of, you know, information being talked about was on Twitter. But when we looked at their perceived main competitor, they had huge numbers on Identica. And
yep.
So I'm going over to Identica to see what they're, you know, what it is they're saying, how they're saying it, the personality of the microblog, to be able to explain that to the execs so they have some sense of who they're capturing or could capture, should they change, modulate their message and push it out to more channels through more tools. Again, you know, the point should never be lost that the whole idea for the 140 character count for Twitter was the 160 character count on text messages.
Of course.
So, you know, we know that, but not everybody remembers that, you know, it was based on something everybody was using, or a lot of people, I should say, were using already.
Well, it wasn't every person. You know, text messaging came into America in full force because of two things, 9/11 and American Idol.
Absolutely.
And let's never forget that. Before that, it was a cell phone was used to make calls. You know, and I remember I had UPOC, you know, website. So UPOC was basically Twitter the first time, and they were a client of mine, and I was talking to the Associated Press. She said, "Well, why should I care?" I said, "Because the next live thing is going to happen on a camera phone." And all of a sudden, she caught it, you know? And then you needed devices like that, like a 9/11 and like a American Idol, to make people realize, okay, text messaging isn't so scary. It can be useful. It can be can save a life, you know? And then you get the great stories about when, in the first season, when American Idol put one of the text numbers was wrong. They put
it up there.
And some woman the next morning woke up with something like 744,000 texts. And they averaged it out that if she actually had to pay for all them, she would have owed like 7% of the house on like $830,000. You know, whatever the next thing is, you know, it doesn't matter. We basically did base Twitter on text messaging. And look, call what you want. Twitter has done one wonderful thing. Access text messaging. It's made people learn how to use their friggin' brevity. It's made people realize that they don't have to give 8 paragraphs in an email before they get to the main point. When you call my voicemail and you listen to it, my voicemail says, please don't leave me a voicemail. Please text me or email me. I promise you I will get back to you faster if you text or email. And people are doing it now, and it's working.
Yeah.
It is awesome. It's working.
Yeah. It's much easier when you have it written down, too.
Why do you think Google's been offering Google 411 for the past 2 years? Not because they're nice. They've been doing it because they now have 86 million voice data prints, and now they've launched Google Voice.
Voice, yeah.
You know, every message gets converted to text, and with 86 million different ways to say the word Harrow, they're not going to screw it up. That's why they've been doing it.
Yeah.
The only time text messaging doesn't work, found this out, I was dating someone. Oh, my God, I had the worst day ever. You know, honey, I'm really in the middle of it. Can you text me about it? No, I can't freaking text you about it. So I learned that, in a personal relationship phase, you know, that kind of may not work all the time. But other than that, really, really good stuff.
Yeah. It's also hard feeling like you're connected sometimes to this network of people. And I remember at a Sharks playoff game, not this year but last year, and watching them win, actually, and I was constantly taking pictures and then uploading them to Facebook or Flickr or both. And
not
then
a moment anymore.
And my husband's sitting there going, "You're not watching the game." I am. This is how I watch a game.
Are you one of those insane? I just gotta interrupt. Are you one of those freaked out insane Shark fans too, like Jennifer Leggio?
I'm not that bad. Hopefully I'm not that bad. No, I don't wear jerseys.
That's like some scary ass stuff there. Media fire on it. Yeah, that just scares me.
Well, I think it's because of the shark thing anyway, you know, but
okay.
Whatever. I don't know. Sharks are a little scary.
But it's true. You weren't watching the game.
Yeah, I was watching the game, and that's how I watch it. So,
yeah.
I mean, I clearly watch things differently than he does, and I think that's a, you know, very interesting thing, you know, in the dynamic of our relationship. I'm constantly seeing how his behavior patterns are different than mine. And, you know, I think, you know, and he's, you know, English, so there's the UK piece. So one of the things is he's, you know, very into, you know, this user forum for this radio host that he sometimes contributes to the show of, Danny Baker, who does a drive time show in the UK, and they have this site called The Treehouse. And he finds out he constantly knows scoop on all the shows happening in the UK, knows nothing about what's happening here. So it's kind of interesting because you can be so if you're an expat, you can stay so true to your country. And this is true of South Africans that I know and others where you can stay so connected these days to your home country. It's almost like you when we then go out and, you know, chat with people about what they're watching or what they're doing or what they've been up to. It's, you know, you still stay really it's like it preserves your nationality in some way. It's very, very strange, the world some people live in, but I definitely see it in mine. So, you know, obviously being a new media veteran like I've been, I'm constantly interested in rich media trends. So video trends, what are you seeing? Anything?
Good question. I will tell you, I'm seeing two things, and I haven't yet figured out how we can merge them into a good conversation that doesn't just go over the place, but what I'm seeing is the merger of things, sites like YouTube and similar, finally working on my BlackBerry. Add that to my favorite device in the whole world, which is the software TiVo to Go.
Yeah, everybody loves it.
Yesterday, yesterday on my flight home from wherever the hell I was. That's really sad. That means I'm traveling too much. Phoenix. I was in Phoenix. My flight home from Phoenix, I finally got through the last two episodes of this season's 24.
Okay.
And when I finished it, I realized that I had watched the entire season, not once, at a television. The entire season was watched on an airplane. That tells me two things. Number one, I'm traveling way too friggin' much. But number two, that I would never have seen it had TiVo2Go not been implemented. Had my laptop not communicated with TiVo2Go every time I got home, where it automatically downloaded the latest episode onto my laptop without my having to do anything, I never would have seen it. And so, if you talk about convergence, I see video becoming more and more, well, not video, I see television becoming more and more back into the mainstream. Look, I'm an early adopter. I have yet to meet anyone that uses TiVo2Go other than me. You know, I'm also the only person with a poking, so, you know, what are you going to do? But I think the fact that we're seeing that this has started, don't rule out giving out information and giving out and selling advertising through traditional television. Because as more people start using TiVo and things like that and downloading them and watching them on the computer, it'll simply be a question. You'll reach 24, will reach the exact same audience you reached 5 years ago. They'll just be reaching them in different locations. And that's going to be really, really, really cool. Because all the advertisers who work on TV are going to go, holy Christ, we've been reborn.
Yeah, we had an IPTV box a couple of years ago.
Yep.
And we're able to get, like, South African programming, South African rugby, for example. And people were like, what? What's that? I have no idea. Because I would go, you know, go to Best Buy, go to Fry's, whatever big box store we go to buy a cable or whatever to run the latest thing. And, you know, my husband, we're very different too. My husband built a media server. So we use our Xbox 360, whatever the premium one is right now, and then the PlayStation as well, as media servers.
Yep.
So we get stuff from all over the world. We've got Netflix. There's no lack of, any movie that's out right now, we're like, oh, we can get it. You know, it's not, you know, there's very few things. We went to Star Trek to see it in IMAX, but there's very few entertainment-related things where I really have to go anywhere. I mean, it's pushed to me where I want to see it. So I think in terms of consumer behavior, that's a huge piece of it, too, is looking at the trend to be able to store large masses of data so much more easily and transfer it online or through your television, through a device attached to your television, and then go to wherever you are.
Yep.
And
no
people don't
about it.
People sort of don't think about that. So the aside from rich media, thinking about another much talked about thing, which is email. You know, some people are predicting the demise of email. We happen to have a client that provides email service that's announced, you know, some interesting things that they're doing with social media in terms of plugging into it and making it more robust. But where do you see email going? I mean, your service for me is something I use via email. It's which includes my BlackBerry, of course. So thank you for sending it out in a format I can read on my phone. But, where do you see email? Do you think the demise of it has been, you know, overrated?
I love getting people who say, you know, email is going to be gone and social media is going to be the wave of the future. And I look at them like, really? You know, how much money are you making on social media? They go, well, in the future, I'm like, really? That's funny because I have a business that I started a year ago that's going to gross a little over $1 million and nothing more than email today.
Yeah.
And they go, that might work. There might still be some use for it. You know, I love the people who are predicting. People have been predicting email doom since email started. And look, the fact of the matter is that when you have something that's perfect, you're not going to want to use it all the time. There are going to be other things that are better for certain things. But in the end, email is a device that works. It simply works.
Why do you think that is?
Because we read information. Anything we get is information. Email is interrupted information. Chances are, if we're getting an email, it's something we have to respond to. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Just like a text works because text is quicker, email works when you need a little more information than a text. And you don't need to show them a freaking movie to do it. You know? And I love that. I love the fact that I can send out the Harrow query and I can get someone onto the Wall Street Journal through nothing more than a basic text email.
Hmm. Yeah, it's something to think about, isn't it?
I mean, I'm not putting down social media. I'm not putting down any of the tools that we're using because, quite frankly, the urgent queries I send out, as I do via Twitter, people love that. You know, people love the immediacy, and that's great. But there is something to be said for a tool that simply works. And I'll give you an idea. It's the same reason that cars haven't started running on tires that are not round and made of rubber in the past 50 years.
Yeah.
Where is the better thing for that?
We could talk about fuel and hydrogen for a long time, though. But I'm going to let you go, Peter. I know you're watching New York. Yeah, that's true. It doesn't affect the tires. I thank you so much for joining us today. I'm going to let you go. And thank all of you who've tuned in to this very entertaining edition of Breakthrough the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Next week, I'm on vacation, but we return on June 5th with special guest Mario Sundar from LinkedIn. That's 2 weeks today at 12 noon Pacific. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show and Eastwick in general at blogs.eastwick.com. Have a great weekend, everyone.